Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the sound. It's John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning into the award-winning For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, this morning, you might say the award-winning For the People has gone to pot. Yes, with the 2017 state legislature already introducing two bills that could legalize the recreational use and sales of marijuana, and state consumer officials poised to expand the number of ailments that could qualify residents to obtain medical marijuana. We'll be opening and closing the show talking about pot. First, in 2010, five citizens from across the state came together to change the way Connecticut viewed marijuana issues. And today, Hemp CT has successfully supported a number of new laws tied to medical marijuana, hemp use and manufacturing, and now they're putting their energies toward legalizing pot for recreational use. So we'll speak with them and then wrap up the program talking with one of the lead physicians on a study at St. Francis Hospital in Hartford aimed at utilizing medical marijuana instead of opioids for post-surgical pain relief. In between, we'll catch up with our friends from Bye Bye Mattress to find out how Connecticut's pioneering mattress recycling program is starting to get traction elsewhere across the nation. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this reminder. Literacy Volunteers is offering volunteer tutor training classes in English as a second language and basic literacy. Tutor training classes will be held in Milford at the Fanny Beach Community Center on Dixon Street from 6 to 8:30 p.m. beginning Wednesday, January 25th, and then in Stratford at the Stratford Library on Main Street from 6 to 8 beginning Wednesday, February 15th. Volunteer tutors learn techniques to assist basic literacy and ESL students with dialogue, listening comprehension, oral fluency, phonics, reading comprehension, and writing skills. And the best part is, no previous teaching experience is required. They'll train you. For more information on Literacy Volunteers of Southern Connecticut's ESL and other volunteer programs, call 203-878-4800 or visit lvsct.org. Well, as we said in the introduction, we're going to open and close the program talking about issues related to marijuana here in Connecticut. At the back end of the program, we're going to be talking about a breakthrough study that's going on at St. Francis, hopefully utilizing medical marijuana to offset the need for opioids in pain recovery from a particular procedure. But we're going to open the program with Cindy Day. She represents Hemp Connecticut, Hemp standing for Helping Educate Misinformed People. They are partnering with Connecticut Normal and Parents for Pot Connecticut at the fifth annual marijuana awareness event that's coming to Bushnell Pavilion in Hartford in the shadow of the Capitol on Saturday, May 6th, in conjunction with the 18th annual Global Marijuana March. Cindy contacted us in order to talk about issues that are going to probably be coming before our state legislators in this session, with Massachusetts just ratifying the legalization of marijuana for personal use and consumption and procurement. Is Rhode Island and Connecticut and other neighboring New England states soon to follow. Cindy, thanks for joining us on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Excellent.
Appreciate it.
Very good. So tell me a little bit about how you got involved with this whole thing.
Well, in 2010, a few people from across Connecticut gathered together at Hartford Library, and we decided we wanted to make a difference. Some of us had different issues, but collectively, marijuana reform was our main focus. And because at that time, there weren't very many organizations out there actually advocating reform hemp CT. So that's where we came. We've been advocating for many issues, starting with the decriminalization. We did the Medical Marijuana, Good Samaritan Act, the Pediatric Medical Marijuana Bill, which passed last year, which was very moving. Mm-hmm. We passed the Industrial Hemp Act. We've been very involved, and we're extending to get direct initiative to the aid in dying. There's a lot of issues that people need advocacy for, and that's what we're here for.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like HempCT has essentially been successful in every venture it has taken on, if not immediately, at least eventually. And I guess a couple of the last things left to do are to broaden the types of ailments that the Connecticut Department of Consumer Protection will allow for dispensing medical marijuana, and potentially, if it is meant to be, create a recreational use and sales component that's taxable here in Connecticut.
Exactly. Speaking of the Department of Consumer Protection, on January 11th at 8:30 in Hartford, the Board of Physicians are meeting to vote to see if they can add ailments, atopic dermatitis, eczema, fibromyalgia, muscular dystrophy, osteoarthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, neuropathy, obstructive pulmonary disease, emphysema, and I'm forgetting one. But they're voting on to see to add those to the present ailments that the medical marijuana program now allows.
Mm-hmm. And based on our coverage of the progression and the introduction and progression of medical marijuana dispensing here in Connecticut, that also seems like, you know, every time a new package of ailments is presented to or through DCP for consideration, correct me if I'm wrong, but most, if not all, of each new grouping of ailments are kind of comprehensively approved, right?
Exactly. But it's a long process to get the Board of Physicians to even acknowledge and to even contemplate adding the recommendation to the Department of Consumer Protection. You know, it takes a lot of research, a lot of legwork from constituents, doctors, patients, family, friends. It's a long procedure, and if more people got involved, maybe you don't have that particular ailment, but you might know a friend or a family member. It is possible to get ailments added. However, the medical marijuana program, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, it's okay.
Has had its bouts of difficulties, the way that it was homogenized in the beginning.
Yeah.
The pricing is unreal. You know, if we're trying to get the black market rid of the black market, but the pricing it's still a little bit expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, together we can all work on a common ground, if you will,
and
actually have this program continue in a positive manner.
Mm-hmm.
I do believe Connecticut is the only self-sustained medical marijuana program.
And certainly even with a few years of track record, this whole thing here in Connecticut is in its infancy still.
Exactly.
Kind of in its initial stages. So there's a lot of learning to do, but at the same time, it appears we have kind of set a precedent, at least in terms of self-sustaining.
Exactly. It's a positive forge forward.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's, again, like you said, infancy. There's a lot of changes that need to be made, and a lot of changes that need to be recognized that need to be made.
And the other interesting thing is how, as you mentioned, you know, first there was very little advocacy. It was still a very under the radar or kind of, you know, backroom kind of thing. There was a lot of stigma, a lot of onus attached to it. But I have to say, in the past 5 years, especially as the medical marijuana component has caught on, not just in Connecticut, but nationally, it seems like that was all it really took to kind of pull the veil off the folks that felt that they had to operate or advocate in the shadows. And it really seems like there is a hugely diverse, sometimes shockingly diverse number of people, both in terms of quality spokespersons and quantity, that are all out there for this.
Exactly. And as you said, the more states have joined on board, nobody wants to take the first step. No legislator wants to lose election because of a question mark in legislation. So the more states that come on board, the easier it is for people to digest that don't understand, especially when people are not ill or have a family member or a friend that's ill and suffering one of these symptoms. They don't know. And it's different. The medical marijuana is not the same as the one that you smoked when you were 18 in college. Mm. You know, there's a CBD, which is more the medical portion, and the THC, which is the high portion.
Mm.
So medical marijuana and recreational marijuana is totally, not totally, but very different from each other.
Yeah, well, I guess the level and the, once again, the diversity of formulation, I guess it's all almost being bred and raised with components that target all of these specific ailments, almost, I guess, in some cases, in a one-on-one basis. I mean, I go back to conversations we had with the folks in Colorado that pioneered the extract for the young children with epilepsy. And, you know, they were saying that it was a one specific component in the oil that was making all the difference.
Right. Well, you are aware that we lost Connecticut's role model for the pediatric medical marijuana bill, Cindy Mae Meehan, last March. Oh. Unfortunately, she passed away before the bill went into effect. The bill was signed on May 4th. She had to move to Maine because she couldn't obtain legal, safe access here in Connecticut, which was really a shame.
Yeah.
Connecticut has nicknamed this pediatric medical marijuana bill the Cindy Mae bill.
Yep, and Maine did just also ratify recreational use on Election Day, as well as Massachusetts, right?
Right, but they had it on direct initiative. I do believe, I'm not quite sure, but I think that the constituents voted.
Hmm.
The legislation didn't. They had it on the ballot.
I see.
And that's what HempCT is trying to do for the next session, is to get direct initiative so constituents, you know, regular voters can go out when they go to vote for your selectman or your representative or your senator, that you can actually vote on an issue.
Okay.
That's another main focus.
Folks, if you just tuned in, we're about halfway through our opening segment, one of two on the program this morning regarding news related to marijuana here in Connecticut. Later, we'll be talking with a representative from St. Francis about a groundbreaking initiative and study to introduce medical marijuana as an offset or replacement for opioids for a specific type of injury and recovery process. Right now, we are on the line with Cindy Day. She represents Hemp Connecticut, HempCT, helping educate misinformed people. They are partnering with Connecticut's chapter of Normal and Parents for Pot Connecticut at the 5th annual marijuana awareness event happening at Bushnell Pavilion in adjacent to the Capitol on Saturday, May 6th. And that is in conjunction with the 18th annual Global Marijuana March. So, Cindy, let's talk about what is old and new again, and then what is new, because we are less than 24 hours from the official opening of the Connecticut legislature, and we have a revived House bill and a brand new Senate bill, both getting floated out there.
Exactly. I may have misunderstood, but session opened yesterday.
Right. Yeah. So as we're recording the program on Thursday, the session just had opened. So
okay, great.
Yep.
Okay. Yes. Senator Louie has introduced Senate Bill 11, which is awesome. It's really a positive push forward. It would pass and legalize recreational marijuana. We're hoping it leaves the Judiciary Committee, which it went to last night. So anybody listening, if you have a representative on the Judiciary Committee, please call them and influence them to please push this out of committee and go for a public hearing so we can get this voted and passed this session. It's a long time coming, and with our present budget and our deficit, the potential revenue from recreational marijuana would substantially put down that overdraft that Connecticut now bears.
Right, right. And that is, I guess, the real driving call, you know, and the fight is, you know, between the individuals who oppose it. Because you know, for the myriad reasons that they have, and those you know, who enjoy it, who would like to not have to feel like or act like criminals to obtain it, and given the fact that it has kind of successfully rolled out in a number of other states, as you're talking with counterparts and colleagues in places like Alaska or Colorado, Washington, D.C., and other areas that are either in the process of or have actually legalized it for recreational use. You know, we heard in Colorado it was like $1 million a month in extra tax revenue in that first year of legalization, you know, making a huge difference.
Exactly. But before we go on, I want to let people know that there is another House bill which was reintroduced this year, which was introduced by Representative Condoleezza out of New Haven in the 95th District, and that, again, is to permit the retail sale of marijuana and provide that the revenue generated from taxation go to the general fund. Again, personally, I'm not into the general fund. I think that money disbursement should be allocated to education, health care, other things, but it's a spark.
Mm-hmm.
Not legal wording yet. And I just really, if you don't mind, I'd like to just put a really big shout-out to each representative that sponsored this bill. May I?
Yes, please.
Okay, Representative Walker, the 93rd District in New Haven. Representative Hurey from the 11th District, which covers Hartford, Manchester, and South Windsor. Representative Haddad, the 54th District from Mansfield. Representative Lamar from the 96th District, who represents North and East Haven. Representative Lesser, 100th District from Middletown. Representative Porter, the 94th District, New Haven and Hamden. Representative Santiago, the 130th District from Bridgeport. And Representative Vargas from Hartford in the 6th District. All these people have come together and are working. We have now, I think it's 5 representatives on board just by the proposed bill, 2 senators, and that's a great start.
Mm-hmm.
Great start. People need to reach out to their representatives and let them know how they feel.
Yeah, pro or con,
exactly.
if you want to read the bills, you can go to House Bill HB 5236 or Senate Bill 11 at ct.gov website. You know, search them and look up the text of the bills. Certainly, if you'd like to get more general information, you can do that either through the normal NRML, right?
It's actually Connecticut spelled out normal.
Connecticut, N-O-R-M-L?
Yes. And let me just, if you mind me interrupting, yeah. Their goal is to move public opinion to legalize responsible use of marijuana by adults. They advocate for consumers to have safe access and convenient and affordable marijuana prices.
Mm-hmm.
And again, for Parents for Pot, the Connecticut chapter, they're just such a wonderful organization. They're a voice for all families who support the end of prohibition. They help families with cannabis issues through education, direct action, and organizational support. And both of these organizations are national. So it's not just Connecticut, and they have a wonderful support group and a vast array of information.
Mm-hmm. And to reach your website, HempCT, you've got a Facebook page, but people can go to hempct.info to access your website.
Right, or they can feel free to email hempct@gmail.com. And we're always getting messages, and they can always join our newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
By doing the same thing, emailing us.
Yeah, and lastly, before we let you go, Cindy, I guess it's also important in the last minute that we have with you to reinforce the element that we haven't really even talked about, and that is so many people whose lives have been ruined because of police records and information in the public record, in the media, about arrests for small amounts of marijuana, and those who have had you know, multiple arrests, who have eventually faced jail time. With Connecticut being a leader in terms of reducing incarceration situations for individuals, particularly in those cases. This does seem like a logical component to that Second Chance Society effort, which started here in Connecticut under Governor Malloy and sort of became a national model under President Obama.
Right. The Public Act 1171, which is a good, the decriminalization, it was great because the first offense, if you carried under or caught with less than a half an ounce of marijuana, the maximum fine incurred was $150, and there was no jail time. Mm. After that, the second offense, it was $500 maximum, but still no jail time, and no, and more importantly, no police record, no criminal record.
Right.
You know, when you're going up to half ounce and 4 ounces, you're going to go a year incarcerated.
Sure.
And, you know, $1,000 maximum fine. So, you know, it's happening out there. As long as we're nonviolent offenses, these should be actually legalized. And I'm just hoping that everybody who's listening calls their representatives and voices their opinion.
Pro or con. That's great. Well, we appreciate you taking some time to start us off talking about the subject, Cindy. Once again, folks, if you'd like to learn more about Cindy's cause, HEMP, which stands for Helping Educate Misinformed People, you can go to hempct.info. You heard earlier in the program their litany of success in relation to hemp and marijuana-related legislation here in Connecticut. They are partnering with Connecticut Normal and Parents for Pot CT for the 5th annual marijuana awareness event at Bushnell Pavilion in Hartford on Saturday, May 6th, in conjunction with the 18th annual Global Marijuana March. Once again, House Bill 5236 and Senate Bill 11, both on track here in Hartford right now. If you'd like to contact your legislator in regards to supporting or opposing those legislative initiatives, we encourage you to do that. And we thank our guest, Cindy, for being part of the program this morning.
Thank you so much.
Stick with us. We've got another segment for you coming up, and then we'll wrap up the program with St. Francis and their segment on this innovative study that they're doing to substitute marijuana for opioids for particular pain control after a specific operation and surgical procedures. So, Cindy, great to meet you. Thanks so much and good
luck.
Thank
you, Doug. We'll talk soon.
Well, we had the pleasure of making the acquaintance of Amanda Wall last year as Connecticut was losing its status as the only state in the country to have a public mattress recycling program. But we're really excited because at the time there were a couple of other states that were poised to launch those programs. And now we're pleased that our neighbors in Rhode Island, as well as the folks over on the other coast in California, are also adopting statewide mattress recycling programs. Buybuymattress.com is their website. Amanda Wall represents the Mattress Recycling Council. And it's a program that's operating in these three states and established by law. And the program uses a recycling fee collected on each mattress and box spring sold to make recycling easier in all the communities in these states. So we wanted to revisit with Amanda because, you know, it's fall. People are doing like fall cleaning, getting ready for winter. A lot of people are buying mattresses or maybe thinking about getting new furniture, doing some remodeling as they kind of look inward to some DIY projects for the winter and holiday season. So we wanted to both remind you about the importance of that this program and why it's so important, and Amanda's the one to do it. Amanda, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, let's get a little bit more detail out of the way. How long ago was it that the Mattress Recycling Council formed and then sought cooperation in states, and Connecticut stepped forward to be sort of the prototype for mattress recycling in the country?
Well, Connecticut passed their law in 2013, And around that time, the Mattress Recycling Council formed, since the law had called for the mattress industry to be responsible for the recycling program. So the mattress industry set up the Mattress Recycling Council. And the law gave us some time to put the program together and put plans in place, and that was roughly about a two-year process. And in that time, we had to present our plan to the state. The state of Connecticut approved it, and then by May 1st, 2015, the program was up and operational in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm. So if you are a customer and you're either calling on the phone to order a mattress in Connecticut, Rhode Island, or California, or you're walking into myriad retailers, sort of from big box department stores to mattress and bedding specialty shops, even to, the thrift stores or jobbers that sell new mattresses. Is there an obligation for those retailers, if you will, to play a role in reminding you as the customer that there's a mattress recycling program in these three states?
Yes. Well, the program is funded through a $9 fee that is collected when a mattress or box spring is sold in the state. And we help the retailers communicate about this because the fee is visible on the receipt. So we provide retailers some customer education materials and assistance. And in general, we want people to visit buybuymattress.com to find their nearest location to where they can drop off their mattress for free, or to look up where one of our recyclers is located in the state. When a mattress or box spring is brought directly to the recycler, there is a $2 reimbursement that is given for each piece.
Oh, okay. Are you finding that to enhance the customer experience, you're getting some segment of the retailers especially the ones that kind of do delivery and mattress pickup, that mm-hmm. they are aiding in the process of facilitating these recycling initiatives at each household?
Yes, we are collecting mattresses not just from over 101 towns and cities in Connecticut, but we have 130 other public and private entities that are participating in recycling their mattresses with our program. So that's everything from mattress retailers to universities, hospitals, military bases, any other business
hotels and
use
things.
Yes.
Ah. Interesting. So that's great. It's the largest users and consumers of mattress beyond the single customer that has a mattress or several in their household. It sounds like that's really helping the program as well as being a real pipeline for the materials in mattresses that you recycle.
Yes. We saw with our first annual report that was recently released to the state, and we presented our findings to municipal leaders and state regulators just this past week, that we've recycled over 150,000 mattresses in the first 14 months of the program, and that's equated to more than 2,800 tons of steel and foam and other materials that can be made into other new useful products. And a good amount of that is from the municipal collection sites that we've established across the state. And then also a good chunk of the mattresses came from the industries that I mentioned earlier, with mattress retailers, hotels, hospitals, universities.
Okay. Are those stats that you're quoting from Connecticut or?
Yes, specifically from Connecticut.
Oh, wow. That's a big, big, big number.
Yes.
Very, very cool. So we're going to take just a moment's a break, and we're going to come back and talk a little bit more to Amanda Wall from the Mattress Recycling Council. Stick with us. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. The Connecticut Department of Veterans Affairs, Vietnam Veterans of America, the VVA Connecticut State Council, and Veterans Legal Services Clinic at Yale Law School have launched the country's first program to notify Connecticut veterans with bad paper discharges about new opportunities to seek discharge upgrades and to connect them with the service providers to assist them in the process. Veterans with discharges below honorable can seek discharge upgrades to access benefits through administrative boards at the Department of Defense. A process that has recently been improved for veterans with post-traumatic stress. For additional resources and information about the discharge upgrade process for veterans and advocates, visit ctlawhelp.org/discharge upgrades. Well, thanks for hanging around. We're with Amanda Wall, who's the marketing and communications coordinator for the Mattress Recycling Council. So, Amanda, now that this program has been in effect for a couple of years in Connecticut, and manufacturers of mattresses, at least the large ones that supply a huge bulk of mattresses and box springs to the retail industry, do you find that they are adjusting the types of materials that they are putting in as a result of the fact that they're being recycled? Or is the mattress industry itself using some measure of the recycled material to make new mattresses as old ones are recycled?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'll take the first part of that where you asked if mattress manufacturers were starting to adjust the types of materials that are going in. And I think you have an interest in this issue. We have a board of directors that oversees our organization. Mm-hmm. And we have representations from different mattress brands and different manufacturers, and there is a segment of the mattress industry that wants to use sustainable materials, have organic materials in their mattress.
Right.
And that's just been my observation.
Yeah. I would imagine consumers, if they had a choice between two mattresses side by side that felt equally comfortable, and even if it cost a little bit more to get mattresses that had, organic or improved, more environmentally friendly materials, they might, mm-hmm. They might throw down a few extra dollars to acquire that mattress. So, with that in mind, how about the back half of the question? Is the industry using the very materials that are being recycled from the products that they make?
No. When a mattress comes through our program, it's being completely dismantled into its main components, which is steel, foam, fibers, wood, and those are being reused in other new useful products. For instance, we're seeing steel being the most lucrative. It can be melted down and used in numerous ways. The foam we see used in other types of cushioning applications, such as carpet underlayment. It's not becoming a pillow or another bed. You could also see foam being used in sound dampening or acoustic uses.
Mm-hmm.
The fibers you can see used in insulation or filter-type products. And then wood is typically chipped, shredded, used as mulch or biomass fuel.
Well, that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. So these mattresses get a lot of environmental mileage out of them once they're processed through a recycling center.
Yes.
Great. So in the last few minutes that we have with you, let's go back to the process. So an individual either goes to a retailer, purchases a mattress, pays the recycling surcharge, takes that new mattress home, and then they can either in Connecticut, in the participating towns, take the mattress to their local or regional landfill, or if they want to take a little bit of an edge off that surcharge, they can drive it to one of the regional recycling centers?
Correct. So our free drop-off locations you typically see at a landfill or a public works yard or a transfer station. We also, in some instances, are working more on an event basis with some of the cities and towns, so we might have a quarterly collection event or be present at another type of community cleanup day that the city has organized.
Mm-hmm. And then there is no it's a simple when you're going to the local landfills, because there's no interaction or surcharge, a partial refund. It's just a matter of dropping it off.
Correct.
But otherwise, if you go to one of the regional centers where they do give you that that couple dollars back, you have interaction with the representative that works there.
Correct. And you can find all our locations on buybuymattress.com. Our collection facilities are clearly marked. Those are the places where you are dropping off for free, and the recycling centers are marked separately.
Fantastic. Anything else that folks in Connecticut need to know about the program or the benefits of recycling?
We are just really excited with the progress that we've seen with Connecticut and look forward to continuing to spread awareness of the program and give residents more access and continue to pull more volume in.
Excellent. In the last couple minutes we have with you, let's just touch upon a couple of other points that people may not realize. When we talk about the ripple effects of recycling a mattress here in Connecticut, it not only reduces the amount of waste that's going into our landfills, but it also keeps our communities cleaner, because I guess it also reduces the likelihood of illegally dumped mattresses, right?
Correct. We have, because of the network of free collection points and the fact that there are several locations in the state where you can even get a portion of your fee back, we hope that that's incentivizing people to put their mattresses in here instead of on the side of the road or in an alley or in another irresponsible way.
Mm-hmm. And to some extent, there is some job creation that that comes from this initiative.
Yes, there is. We have one of the recyclers that we work with is a nonprofit organization that uses mattress recycling as a way to teach job skills and job readiness. And it's been a pleasure to work with them and see their organization grow and help more people.
The Mattress Recycling Council, based in Alexandria, Virginia, operates the mattress recycling programs, the first in the nation here in Connecticut, and now in our neighboring Rhode Island, as well as in California. If you'd like to find out more about the process, buybuymattress.com is the website. And Amanda, once again, we thank you for your great work and look forward to talking to you again when a few new states are added to the complement for states that are doing the mattress recycling program like we are in Connecticut. Thanks for taking our call this morning. Well, we've talked a lot on this show to officials and pharmacists and others about Connecticut's allowing of the use of medical marijuana for a number of ailments. We have talked on dozens of programs in the past few years, especially about the opioid epidemic and the toll that it's taking and the causes and the social costs. And now we're kind of bringing these two things together over the course of a couple of reports, beginning with this one. We're so pleased to welcome Dr. James Feeney, who is the Director of Trauma Services at St. Francis in Hartford. St. Francis Hospital and Medical Center, a great resource for our program here, and I'm glad we're able to bring you, Dr. Feeney, into the fold. So the big news is that the Connecticut Department of Consumer Protection that oversees medical marijuana growing and distribution here in Connecticut has aligned with St. Francis Hospital and Medical Center's medical marijuana research program, approved that program, and now the goal is going to be to determine whether or not medical marijuana can effectively replace opioids, particularly oxycodone, in patients with post-traumatic acute, subacute, and chronic pain. Specifically now, this is going to be targeted, I guess, for individuals who are suffering with these painful rib fractures. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, that was the whole idea of the program, was to see if we could scale whether it works well for chronic pain and for cancer pain into something that I think is, you know, very immediate. When it happens to somebody, they need pain control pretty quickly. And that's never been tried or proven, at least in the U.S.
So from where I sit and amongst the people who I talk to at all levels of this this opioid crisis, so many of the stories that have become nightmares for individuals and families and communities have started so innocently with individuals who have something like a rib fracture, an ankle break, some broken bone sprain or what have you. They consult their doctors. They get their treatment. Part of that treatment is an opioid-based painkiller. And then 3 months, 6 months, a year, 2 years later, these individuals too often have become addicted to the opioids, and in too many cases have, due to the financial constraints of maintaining that illegal habit and not being able to access opioids through pharmaceutical channels because they're no longer really medically required, they turn to heroin and other substances, and it's a downward spiral from there. So this is
exactly
a fantastic initiative. Tell me a little bit about the inception and the idea and the inspiration behind St. Francis's Medical Marijuana Research Program.
So it was really born out of viewing the press release that the state of Connecticut was going to start to allow research into medical marijuana. I saw the press release, and the first thing I did was went to one of my partners and said, hey, you know, the state's going to start to allow research into medical marijuana for conditions other than the 22 listed conditions that people in the state can already get medical marijuana for. We should try this for trauma. And my partner immediately said, that's a fantastic idea. Hospital's never going to go for it. And even if the hospital goes for it, our institutional review board that oversees all of the research that's done in the hospital, they're never going to go for it. And even if they go for it, I don't think this is what the state is looking for. And I said, well, before we give up too easily, let's just go ask.
And was that was that partner Dr. Rodas?
No, that was Dr. Shapiro.
Oh, okay.
Who's one of the trauma surgeons that I work with, and you know, is very active in our most of our research programs. And he and I kind of bounce ideas off of each other for research projects. And so Shapiro said, "Well, let's start with a call to legal." So we called the legal department here in the hospital, and our legal representative said, "Fantastic idea. You should definitely look into this more." So we talked to the chief of surgery. We talked to Dr. Rodas, who's the president and CEO. Dr. Rodas was extremely supportive. He said, I can't believe we're not already doing this. Then we went and talked to the chief physician executive for Trinity Health New England, Dr. Steve Ruby. And Dr. Ruby was more than supportive. He said, this is a fantastic idea. You guys have to do this. So everybody we talked to at the hospital level, at the legal level, they all thought it was a fantastic idea because, just as you said, you know, you have 1.9 million Americans addicted to opiates, and a fairly large percentage of them will turn to heroin when the doctors turn off the oxycodone spigot and say, I'm done treating you for pain now, you have to go away.
Mm.
And that's starts that vicious cycle that you mentioned that can lead to ruining of lives and families and even communities.
Mm. So, Dr. Feeney, let me interrupt you there and ask, given the way things are going on that front, what was the yours and Dr. Shapiro's concern that it wouldn't fly from the get-go?
Well, I think, you know, St. Francis is still a Catholic hospital with very Catholic-based mission statement, and we were concerned that a drug of abuse that is federally Schedule One, even though it's recognized as legal in the state of Connecticut, would not be looked upon keenly as a research topic, because I think the hospital has a very keen mission to protect patients from medical harm, and I think they've had a legacy of trying to protect people from medical harm, and no one really does more of that than my partner, Dr. Shapiro, who's one of the patient safety advocates. And, you know, that's what I think he was concerned about, that the hospital wouldn't agree. But when we discussed it with the hospital, they were full speed ahead.
That's great. So from 10,000 feet, let's start a different conversation to help educate myself and the folks that are listening. Can you quickly and in layman's terms sort of describe the difference between the way oxycodone will alleviate pain in a rib fracture versus what you understand about the way medical marijuana would work?
Right. So opioids, all of which are based from opium and then later morphine, it's all pretty much the same drug from the same compound. Opiates relieve pain by acting on something called the mu opioid receptors. There are several receptors that they work on, but the mu opioid receptor is the basic receptor that centrally helps a person to feel like, you know, their pain is either tolerable or it's not there. That is not what marijuana uses in order to alleviate pain. There are cannabinoid receptors that are called CBD1 and CBD2, and there's also a THC receptor, and they also work on a different receptor called a kappa receptor. So in a very basic pharmacologic, physiologic sense, they work in different places in the brain to help alleviate pain. From that 30,000-foot view, the thing about opioids that people don't like is, one, they're addictive. Two, they have bad side effects, right? So the bad side effects include things like sedation. They make people feel absolutely terrible.
Mm.
I had one person describe the use of morphine to me as, it didn't help my pain. It just made me not care that it was there.
Mm.
Right? And then in addition to that, they're addictive. In fact,
and the lower GI issues too.
Right.
Right.
So they take away a person's appetite. They make a person constipated. They have a fairly high number of pretty bad side effects. Medical marijuana, on the other hand, doesn't really have those side effects. They're not addictive in the sense that, you know, it's a bit of a loaded question. I got called to task by one of my colleagues for saying that they're non-addictive.
Mm.
You know, the definition some use of addiction is you keep doing it even when you know bad things are happening to you because of it. In that sense, certainly there are people who like using marijuana so much that they don't care to go out and get a job. They lose the job they have. They do poorly in school or, you know, perform poorly at other tasks in life.
Mm.
And certainly that's a problem with the use of marijuana, but we're not talking about recreational marijuana use. We're talking more about a medicalized marijuana use with a very controlled dose.
Mm.
So in that sense, the withdrawal symptoms are things like dry mouth and irritability and loss of appetite. Compare that with opiate withdrawal, which is very severe, although not fatal, and causes people extreme discomfort. And even pain, abdominal pain and cramping, there's really no comparison between the withdrawals of the two drugs. So in that sense, opiates are really non-addictive. They don't really have drug-drug interactions, and they don't affect a person's GI tract the way you mentioned. You don't get nauseated from them, and people don't really get the constipation that they get with opiates.
I see. Good. Folks, if you're just tuning in, we're having a very enlightening conversation with Dr. James Feeney. He's director of trauma services at St. Francis Hospital and Medical Center in Hartford. Their medical marijuana research program was recently approved by the Connecticut Department of Consumer Protection specifically to try to create a substitute for the opioid drug oxycodone in patients who specifically have what they're calling post-traumatic acute, subacute, or chronic pain from multiple rib fractures. We've got about 4 or 5 minutes left with Dr. Feeney. My next question, Doctor, would be, we hear all these stories about individuals, some as young as adolescents, having these injuries. They're prescribed, or dental work for that matter. They're prescribed an opioid for temporary pain relief, and 6 months, a year and a half down the road, these individuals are in bad shape, addicted, and as you mentioned, in many cases, turning to heroin because they can no longer get the pharmaceutical opioid relief. So when it comes to medical marijuana, when you're using it as a strategic prescription for pain, do you have any data or even anecdotal information as to how many of these patients might likely continue on seeking the relief that medical marijuana provides on the black market or by other means once the period of their medical marijuana prescription has lapsed and the pain, and the recovery from, in your case, these rib fractures has actually healed?
Well, that is actually part of the data that we're going to collect. Those are some of the other endpoints that we're going to look at for this study. There's maybe a little bit of evidence coming out of the Netherlands and out of Europe that people who use medical marijuana for pain can stop using it pretty easily. There are some anecdotal reports from Canada before marijuana was legal for medical use in Canada of people who would kind of seek out marijuana illegally and use it for pain after an operation, and then went back to their old habits, which was, you know, intermittent use. Mm. So there's not a ton of data about that, and that's part of what we're going to look at, and that's the reason that we're doing the study the way we're doing it. We want to see if people at the end of the study want medical marijuana for pain control for their subacute or chronic pain at that point from rib fractures. We want to see if they ask for that more often than the people who were getting oxycodone and OxyContin ask for repeat prescriptions for that.
Mm.
So that's exactly one of the things that we're very interested to find out before we can do this study on a larger scale.
Mm. But right now, anecdotally, there is reason to believe and be optimistic that the way so many individuals have come out of their prescription period for opioids tend to be a much worse outcome than individuals who emerge from their period of treatment for medical marijuana.
That's true. It's very anecdotal, very basic, but you're right. It's very encouraging, very tantalizing that right. This could be something you use and then stop. Easily.
So where do you go from here in the last couple minutes that we have? How many patients do you think you can accommodate in this study over the period of time that would be the minimum amount that would provide you with some satisfactory and usable data?
So the first step is the study that we were approved for is for 60 patients. We're going to give half those patients medical cannabis and half the patients opiates. The medical cannabis patients will have a prescription for opiates with them that they can turn to if the medical cannabis doesn't work for them. And from that, we're going to gain this preliminary data so that we can show the institutional review board that oversees all of our research that this is effective and safe and that people don't have bad side effects from it. after we can demonstrate that with a reasonably high quality proof of concept trial, which is what we're calling this, then we want to do a larger randomized control trial with about 150 to 160 patients in each arm to try to see exactly how much or how well we can reduce the morphine equivalent usage in that population. So this is the first step, just to sort of prove to the IRB that it's safe and that it's effective. And then once we do that, then we want to move to a randomized controlled trial.
So you're looking at a 12 to 24-month window, something like that?
I think the first step will take us 8 months, and the second step will take us about a year to a year and a half. That's right.
Okay, good. Excellent. Well, this is fantastic news, Dr. Feeney, and we really hope that we can check in with you in process and see how this is all going, because certainly it's groundbreaking here in Connecticut, a very exciting prospect when we're looking at this opioid scourge that the state and the nation are facing, and really pleased to see that it's come home to Hartford and that the Connecticut Department of Consumer Protection has recognized its value and its partnership with St. Francis Hospital and Medical Center's Medical Marijuana Research Program and yourself and Dr. Shapiro. Congratulations, and we look forward to talking with you more about this as the program rolls out. Thanks for taking some time to talk to us and learned a lot. Very educational. Thanks for your time. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours in the New Haven area at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford, and for our Hartford stations at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab at our radio station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.